Let it just catch up a minute. A couple of technical difficulties this end. There we go. Yep, there we go. All right, guys, I'll just give you a couple of minutes just to come in and so we can start. I'll just pin this to the top of my page. There we go. Hey guys, welcome to Live and Undrugged episode 5. As always, thanks to my sponsors, Mr. James Jeffries and Cannabis CBD. I will put the link in the comments after. I'm speaking to Amy Garvey. Amy is going to speak about her life and ultimately her recovery and her job. Hi, Amy. Thanks for coming on.
Hi. Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Yeah. So let's go back to the start. Really. Let's go back to the start of your journey.
Okay. How far back shall we go?
The very far back as you like. Whatever you feel comfortable with.
Okay. Well, I'll start by saying that I am currently 46 years old in recovery and sober for 7 years, going on 8. It'll be 8 on the 23rd of February. And I'm a freelance copywriter working from home. I went and did that in August of 2020, so a little before you started the podcast. And but going back, I think I'd probably be best to go back to when I was about 6 years old, which is way, way back. That's the first time I remember wondering if other people thought the way that I think. That's the first time I remember becoming consciously aware of the fact that most of the people I knew, most of the kids that I knew, did not think the way that I thought. They didn't wonder what other kids were thinking. And I did, all the time. I wanted to know what was going on in other people's minds, if they thought the way that I did. And that sort of, I guess, started me on a journey of exploration, for lack of a better way to put it. So I wouldn't say necessarily that I was a daredevil, but I was always open to trying new things. And my writing began not too long after that. I think I was in the fourth grade when I won a prize for a short story that I had done. And my reward was to be able to audit a creative writing class at a local university. And I was very, very blessed in that Maya Angelou was the guest speaker for that particular weekend class. So I listened and I learned, and I, at 10 years old, figured out how to take notes very quickly. college level course, I certainly wasn't quite prepared for that, but I gleaned a lot from it. And I had a chance to speak with Ms. Angelou, and I asked her what advice she would give, you know, a 10-year-old, a kid just starting out. And she said, write. Very simple, just write. She said, write every single day. Even if it's trash and you throw it away, write. I said, okay. So I started keeping a journal and have done so for going on 40 years. When I don't feel like writing, if I don't have any assignments for clients or customers, and I don't have anything, any project that I'm working on, I still write in my journal every day. I do daily devotionals, and I write my thoughts about those as well in a notebook that I keep, several notebooks that I've kept over the years. And then fast forward to my teen years, my mother and sister both smoked, and I wanted to know what that was like. So I think I was maybe 12 or 13 when I tried a cigarette for the first time, and I wish I never had because I loved it. I didn't choke, I didn't cough, I didn't hack, I didn't spit. I liked the taste of it. I liked the feel of it. It wasn't anything about being grown up. It wasn't peer pressure. I stole one from my sister and smoked it by myself. I wasn't in a group of friends. Nobody tried to talk me into it. I never tried to talk anybody else into it because I knew it wasn't good for you, but I liked it. And I also, about that time, had my first taste of liquor. My parents had just gotten a divorce when I was in the fifth grade, trying to figure out the timeline here. I guess that would make me about 12, heading into sixth grade that summer. A friend of mine, her parents had also gotten divorced, and our families were the only two in my entire elementary school. I was in a very small area, very rural South Carolina. I went to an elementary school in a town that has one stoplight and about 18 churches. To give you an idea, we are definitely in the Bible Belt. And my mom had a very modest stash of liquor. She didn't drink very often, but she did keep some things in the house. And she went somewhere to run an errand or what have you. She was going to be gone most of the day. And my friend and I were at my house, and we just got to talking about it and decided we wanted to try it. So we did. And like the cigarette, I liked it. Very first try. We made screwdrivers, basically. We mixed orange juice and vodka, not knowing what we were doing, just messing around. And the next year, headed into, well, in the middle of my eighth grade year. So that was a few years later. Didn't drink much, just occasionally when I could sneak it in. It was certainly not at that point anything even like an obsession. It was just something to do occasionally. But then I moved in with my dad and stepmom when I was 14, getting ready to turn 15, and in the middle of my eighth grade year. Eighth grade was very, very difficult for me. My parents moved me to a private school, where everybody had been together their entire school careers, and I was the new kid coming in. And they really, I befriended a couple of girls who wound up being the mean girls, and they turned on me, which happens, especially with that age group. Girls can be really, really cruel. Boys fight and get it over with. Girls will stalk their prey and do everything within their power to bring you down. And it worked. That was one of the worst years of my life, still to this day. But about towards the end of the year, there was another new girl who came in and befriended the same group of girls, and they did the exact same thing to her. They turned on her, and they tried to get me back into the clique and against this other girl. And I, for the first time in my life, took a stand on something publicly. And I, because the teacher had not come into the classroom yet, I think it was US history. And I stood up and I said, I'm not doing this. You've got to be kidding me. You guys have made this entire year fucking miserable for me. And now you're expecting me to turn around and do the same thing to someone else, and I refuse. And I befriended this girl. We are still friends to this day. Not real tight, but, you know, good Facebook friends. We Christmas cards and chat periodically, that sort of thing. Because I just refused to give in to something that I knew was wrong. I knew it was cruel, it was mean, it was hurtful, and it was just wrong. And it felt good. It felt really, really good to stand up for the underdog and be in the right place and be able to do something about it. So fast forward a little bit further along. most of my friends have typically been older than me. I've just always been attracted to folks who are a little bit more mature, even in high school. And so my friends, when I moved in with my dad and stepmom, I went to another private school on a headmaster's scholarship and fit in much better there. As we were moving into high school, there were a couple of new kids coming in, so I wasn't the only one, which was nice. And I got in at the start of the year rather than the middle of the year, which helped a little bit too. And I made some good friends, and a number of them were juniors and seniors. My boyfriend was a junior. Went to the prom and all of that. And that's when I started drinking somewhat more regularly, I would say, pretty much every weekend. There was a party at somebody's house, and parents would leave town and leave cash for the kids to be checked in on by a maid or a housekeeper, that sort of thing, basically make sure everybody's still alive. But they were, you know, 17, 18 years old, and the parents trusted them to be responsible at home alone. And of course, they were not. they were 17-year-old kids with 15-year-old friends. And so about that time, I also tried pot for the first time and enjoyed that and went, huh, I see a trend. Even then, I went, okay, I tried cigarettes. I like those. I tried alcohol. I like that. Tried pot. I like that. I need to be careful. So being the geek that I was, I actually went to the library and looked up addictive substances because I didn't want to try anything that I could get addicted to, ironically. Alcohol was not listed at that time as an addictive substance. They were looking at heroin, cocaine, meth, that type of thing, the harder drugs. And so I thought, well, hey, I'm golden, right? No big deal. Come to find out in looking at family history, my grandfather on my dad's side was an alcoholic. His other son, my uncle, was an alcoholic and had mental health issues as well. He died homeless in Florida, despite family support and willingness to help. I was not close to him. He actually abused me when I was very young. And so I don't know much of that story. I just know that it's not a good one. Lord have mercy, trying to figure out where to go from here. So I had been having mental health issues, severe depression, to the degree that for the first part of my senior year of high school, I barely got out of bed. I got out of bed to go to school and do my schoolwork and the sports that I had to do for school because they were required. I ran track and played field hockey. And beyond that, I went home and slept. And that's all I did. It's all I could do was sleep and cry and cry and sleep. And my dad decided, or my dad and stepmom and mom all decided to put me in therapy. We went to see a good therapist, I thought, a good family therapist. And she pulled my dad in and said, John, you know, a lot of this is stuff that you need to deal with too. My dad traveled a lot for work. He was gone pretty much every week. He tried to be home on the weekends. Sometimes it was every other weekend. Some of the rules were if I didn't have the trash out by the time he got home on Friday, and it was different every week as to what time he got home, depending on what flight and where he was coming from. But if I didn't have the trash out by the time he got home on Friday, I wasn't allowed to go out that weekend, period. No exceptions. By that point, I really didn't care too much. But he would do things when my sister and I were younger. I remember one time in particular, we swept the garage. That was one of our chores on a given day. And he came out to inspect it and it was not good enough. So he took the dirt from the dustpan, scattered it all over the garage and made us sweep it again. The second time wasn't good enough. He did it again and we had to sweep it again. And we were maybe 8 and 10 years old, my sister and I, at this point. Way too young, in my opinion, as a parent now, to be expecting perfection. But my father always demanded perfection. Nothing was ever good enough. It still isn't to this day. He'll come over to my house and I'll have it spotless and fix a nice dinner and everything's going great. And he'll go into the bathroom and say, you need to clean the vent on the ceiling. And I'm like, really? That's what you pick out? But that's just the way he is. And I've come to learn now that I am a parent myself, my daughter's actually off in college. So I've had a couple of years to think about it. And I've realized as a parent, you inherently love your children and you do the best that you can with what you have at that time. And while it's not necessarily a brand of love that I can get behind, that I can feel, I know that's his way of showing that he loves me because he's trying to make things better for me. he's not just pointing out the things that are wrong. He's trying to help me improve the situation, whatever that situation may be. That's his way of showing love. Now, that doesn't mean that I have to accept it or that it works for me. And that's been a hard lesson to learn. That's been a real hard nut to crack over the years. But I accept that that is what it is. That is his way of showing that he loves me. And we still have a somewhat stilted relationship, but we do have a relationship, which is a dramatic improvement over 20 years ago. So going back to my 17-year-old self, Ginger Culbertson was the name of the therapist. I remember her name all these years later. And she said, John, you're going to need to make some changes if you want this relationship to work. If you want Amy to get healthy and life to improve, then you're going to need to make some changes. And he said, there's nothing wrong with me. And he took me to a psychiatrist. And I told the psychiatrist basically the same things that I had told the therapist. They locked the doors. I was escorted by police to the local mental health ward, where I was committed for 2 weeks involuntarily by my parents.
It's hard.
It was very hard. Very hard. Especially in the middle of your senior year of high school, you don't get to say goodbye to your friends. You don't get to do anything. You're just carted off. And I hadn't done anything wrong. Pardon?
How did that feel?
Oh, God, it was awful. Embarrassing. Humiliating. Desperate. I felt abandoned. I felt like my dad didn't want to deal with me, so he just put me off in this place to kind of get rid of me and make it all my problem. Hindsight being what it is, I'm aware of the fact that I do, in fact, have a mental illness. I have bipolar disorder. Mm-hmm. And I'm good with that. It's taken a number of years to come to terms with it and to get medication adjusted, that sort of thing. But, you know, at that time, I was diagnosed with borderline personality syndrome and bipolar disorder, which is really, quite frankly, ridiculous, because you can't diagnose bipolar disorder until the brain has completely developed at the age of 25. So what they were doing diagnosing a 17-year-old with bipolar and putting me on lithium is beyond me. But that's the way things went back then. This is the early 90s, and that was the best they could do. So we tried lithium. We tried a handful of other medications. Nothing really seemed to work. But when I got out of the hospital, I was released immediately after my two-week commitment, mandatory commitment. I was released the next day with no mandatory aftercare, because they really couldn't see that I had any issues. I wasn't a danger to myself or to anyone else, in other words. So I never went back to my dad and stepmom's house. I had my mom go pack my things for me. My mom and I guess my stepmom probably helped pack up all of my stuff. And a good friend of mine and I had already been discussing getting an apartment together. We found one right behind the school that I attended, and she and I moved in together the very next day. All of this coordinated by letter writing and phone calls, because there was no internet. you know, it's kind of hard to imagine now, but that's how we coordinated and we managed to make it work. And so I moved out of my parents' house when I was 17, and worked at a restaurant where I had been working since I was 15, explained to the manager what had happened. He was on board and, you know, happy to have me. I started out as a hostess and then cashier and then waiting tables, bartending, and ultimately managing. And I did it all while putting myself through school. I would get up in the morning and walk to school. I didn't have a car. This friend of mine worked at the same restaurant, and she would give me rides to and from work, as would a couple of other folks as well, to, you know, when I needed it. And I had a bike, and I lived 5 miles from the restaurant. When I had to, I biked to work, because you do what you got to do. And being jolted the way that I was, being committed and then being released and moving out on my own, really broke the cycle of depression. I don't think it was so much any of the medication that they gave me at the hospital as it was the wake-up call that this is your new life. I finally had enthusiasm again and wanted to get up in the morning, looked forward to doing things with my friends, just being normal. About that time, though, especially most people know restaurant industry is pretty rife with alcohol and drug abuse. I think in part because you get done at midnight or 2 o'clock in the morning and the only thing open is bars. So I was partying with the older folks, never got carded. Now I got cut off at the library one time. I've gotten cut off at the library, never got cut off at a bar, ever, even at 18. Never got carded and never got cut off. I don't know how, because I looked like a 13-year-old boy when I was 18 years old. I had short bob haircut and no figure whatsoever, but somehow it just worked, I guess, probably because of the folks that I was hanging out with. They just assumed that I was old enough. And so we drank and partied pretty heavily back in those days. And for the most part, we were safe about it. We either had a designated driver, or at this point I had moved downtown and was working at a restaurant in downtown in another town in South Carolina. And I would ride my bike to and from work. So I didn't worry too much about drinking and driving. I figured if I got hurt, it would only be me. I'm not going to hurt anybody else on my bicycle. So did that for about 2 or 3 years, saved up enough to buy my first car, which I paid outright for. Very proud moment as I was making my way in the world. And I, throughout this time, was seeing psychiatrists, but I was a human dartboard. It was, here, try this medication for 6 weeks. Oh, that one didn't work. Well, let's try this one instead. That one didn't work. Well, let's add this one. And then, you know, next thing you know, 10 years has gone by. I dated some. One fellow that I dated, I'll tell you that story in a moment, but he is actually my boyfriend now. We've been together for about 4 years. 3 or 4 years. It's all starting to run together. And we dated for about 2 years. And shortly after we broke up, I met and then married my first husband. Things were good for about a year or so. We both had what I would probably call problem drinking. I don't know that I would say full-blown alcoholic at that point, because I was putting myself through college. And, you know, when I had big things coming up, I didn't drink because I needed to be clear headed and focused and know what I was doing. So I was able to not drink when I wanted not to drink, which is why I say that. Pardon?
I would call that high functioning.
Right. Right.
You know, with my experience, I could function with alcohol or whatever, very well at one point, but it didn't make me any less of an alcoholic. You know, some may disagree, but I think that you know.
Well, and I'll get into the alcoholism in just a minute. But at that stage of my life, I don't think that I would put myself as an alcoholic yet. Let's call it a budding alcoholic. I was definitely headed in that direction, but I could still stop when I needed to. And I did occasionally. My first husband came home from work drunk one night and punched me after an argument or in an argument. I waited until he passed out. I called my mom and I said, come get me. She and my stepdad and my brother-in-law came the next day while my husband was at work with a U-Haul, and we packed up all my stuff, left the furniture that was his and his belongings. And I moved back in with my mom, put my stuff in storage at, you know, how old was I then? 28, 29 years old, moved back in with my mom. That was a bit of a step down and a bit of a wake-up call, but you do what you got to do. I was not going to be abused physically. No. So, didn't date for a while after that, a couple of years, But then I met and married my second husband and had my daughter. Of course, as soon as I found out that I was expecting her, I dumped the tequila down the sink, and that was it. I didn't drink during my pregnancy. I managed to quit smoking with the help of some Wellbutrin, I think is what I took at that time. And quit smoking pot as well. I just quit everything because I wanted to have a healthy child. And I was able at that point to quit. So Kate was born healthy and wonderful, and we hunkered down. She was born in November, late November. We had a big ice storm shortly thereafter, and we kind of hunkered down, and my ex bought me a bottle of tequila and a bottle of wine. I was nursing, and we just sat together and watched Lord of the Rings, the whole trilogy. And, you know, life goes on. Eventually he and I split. Kate was about three, I think, at the time, and I became a single mother, and I rented a duplex, a half of a duplex, and did all the mommy stuff. I went to Girl Scouts. I was a Girl Scout mom and chaperone. And when it was time to dye Easter eggs, all of my nieces came over to my house because I always did the messy stuff. I did the Easter egg dyeing and making cookies and homemade icing. And I had a garden and let the kids dig in the dirt and took them camping and all that kind of stuff. And absolutely loved it. I drank, but not very heavily. It was more the occasional glass of wine at that point in my life, quite frankly, because I was too busy living life, you know. And then my daughter got older and my bipolar got worse, and I began self-medicating with alcohol. Not the pot so much. I did still smoke occasionally, but that was not my go-to, and I didn't use any other drugs. Had alcohol been listed as a drug when I went and looked it up years and years before, perhaps I would have gone a different direction, because I had realized then that I had an addictive personality and knew better than to mess with other things. But the alcohol was perfectly fine, of course. Yeah. The one acceptable substance.
Socially acceptable. Everybody does it, and that, you know, you're made to think and you're made to feel that because you have a problem with it, why should other people have a problem with it? And you know that, hence the guilt trips and stuff like that. I can feel you there.
I had done one stint as an AmeriCorps VISTA, which is Volunteers in Service to America. You live at the poverty rate, that is your rate of pay, but they also put you on all of the social, in all of the social safety nets. So I was on Medicaid and food stamps and all of those programs, because they want you to serve from a place of understanding the people that you serve. That's the whole point of becoming an AmeriCorps VISTA, right? Basically. But you work with an organization that pays your salary, and in order to create sustainable activities, sustainable programs. So I worked with a group called Middle Tiger Community Center, with their food pantry and emergency utility assistance programs and that kind of stuff, doing a lot of writing, and really enjoyed the work. I didn't even mind being broke all the time. You know, I had enough to live off of, and that's really all. When you've got what you need, you're okay.
Yeah.
And that's sort of what that year taught me, is that you don't have to be well off to be okay and to be happy. And you find free things to do around town. You know, my daughter and I would pack a picnic and go look at different art studios. We don't really have any museums in this town, but we have a couple of different art boutiques and that sort of thing. Or we would go downtown and look at all of the different water displays, all the fountains and such, and play in the water. you get creative when you're broke, I learned. And the second year, the depression came back very, very badly, and I attempted suicide and wound up in the hospital. We were able, for the most part, to keep it from my daughter because she was way too young. I think she was maybe 9 or 10 at that time. It's an embarrassing thing to admit, but it's an important thing to admit.
I don't think it's embarrassing. You know, I've been there, and I've been poor. In fact, I met my wife at a food bank. She was serving, and I was homeless. You know, I've tried suicide many times. The last one resulted in me popping a gun in my mouth. It's not easy. It's not, no. And I don't think you should ever be embarrassed about being there. I think that society tries to embarrass you sometimes, but I do think that it is getting better because people like you and I speak openly and freely about it, and we need to. Mm-hmm. This is why we do this. This is why I do this.
Yeah.
I don't. Who else is going to?
When you reach that point of desperation, you know, I had another near attempt, but I was able to get a friend on the phone. And I said, please just talk to me. I don't care what about, just talk to me. And she did. And we stayed on the phone for about an hour. And after that, I was okay. It's important that people know that these feelings are not, unfortunately, even unusual, and that it's okay. Sometimes you need to just sit with it and be depressed and wallow in it and have a pity party even. You can't do that forever, but, you know, sometimes life is just difficult and it just sucks. And sometimes you just need to sit and be there in that moment. The important thing is, once the moment passes, you got to put on your big girl panties and get up and do something about it. You can't stay in that spot, or you will wind up doing something that, if you live to regret it, you'll regret it. Anyway, fortunately, failed suicide attempt and was able to come home to my daughter, made up some excuse for the scratches on my wrists, the bandages on my wrist, and she was young enough to buy it. I wasn't able to work for quite some time, and we were in danger of losing the apartment. And my dad and stepmom blessedly came in and helped me buy a house. I made sure that we were going to be in the same school district so that my daughter could continue going to the school that she was attending. It was the best in the city, and, you know, those things matter. But the depression wasn't any better. And so I wound up getting on disability. It took a couple of tries, as it normally does. And because I was on disability, you can't work when you're on disability. You can, but you can only earn X number of dollars. And I had always done copywriting as a sideline gig, which started before I was even out of college. A friend of mine had graduated law school and said, hey, can you help me with my brochures? So I did his brochures and I did his letterhead and, you know, a number of other things. And he told someone else who told someone else who told someone else. So I'd never advertised. I just had always had a steady trickle, I would say, of writing clients. And so I was still doing a little bit of that on the side. But for the most part, I was sitting at home watching TV and playing games on the computer and drinking pretty much all day. Because I would get my daughter to school and I'd come home and I'd have a little bit of coffee. And then it's like, well, I know it's only 10 o'clock, but I'll just have one shot. Right. So you have the one shot. And then an hour later, you have another. And then 30 minutes later, you have another. And the next thing you know, it's 2 o'clock in the afternoon. You need to go pick up your child and you're shit faced. On those days, I would call my ex-mother-in-law. I would call family friends. I would call my mom. I would call whomever to pick up my daughter, because the one thing I didn't do was drive drunk. I was always very cautious about that until the day that I wasn't. And that started really because I would get up at 6 o'clock in the morning to get Kate up and get her dressed and ready for school, get breakfast made, lunch made, and all of that good stuff, get everybody out the door. But I would be shaking violently. And so I'd have to do a shot or two just to be able to fix breakfast and lunch and to drive her to school. And that's a really sad thing to admit, that at 6 o'clock in the morning, I was doing shots to steal my hands so that I could make lunch for my daughter for school. So that went on for a number of years. I was still seeing a psychiatrist. We were still trying to treat the bipolar. Of course, I was counteracting that with the alcohol. But at the same time, you know, when you find the right meds, you find that you don't really need the alcohol so much. This went on for a while, and a dear friend of mine whose daughter was good friends with my daughter sat me down on the back porch and said, you know, you're going to lose your child if you keep this up. And for me, that was a wake-up call, because nothing mattered more except maybe the alcohol. And that was a sad truth to realize. So I checked myself in voluntarily for another 2-week commitment at that same hospital. Now, it has grown and improved dramatically in the 20 years in between, but they had a 6-week long program that was voluntary that you had to be nominated for and approved for by 2 different psychiatrists and a therapist. In other words, they don't take the program lightly, and they want to ensure that you don't either, which is a good thing. I managed to get into the program after the 2-week commitment period. I stayed for an additional 6 weeks, and Kate stayed with her dad and my mom and his mom, and we made it work. And I learned a lot about alcohol. I learned a lot about the brain, how it works on alcohol with and without. I learned a lot about sobriety. I developed essentially a toolkit of things to do to keep myself busy in lieu of drinking. Colored pencils. I love to color. Painting with acrylics, crochet, playing piano, going for a hike. I've got a whole list of things to do. And then I found a new psychiatrist. And he's the only one in the state who does DNA testing. But he does it so that he can look and see, okay, where are the gene mutations and what is the best therapy at this time for those specific things. And he found that I do, in fact, actually have bipolar disorder. I was missing a number of things. Predominantly, my body was not producing serotonin and norepinephrine at all. Then on top of that, I don't know, I'm sure you're probably familiar with the term SNRI or SSRI. SSRI is a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor. And what that means is you've got neurons firing serotonin and neurons that are taking it in. And the ones that are taking it in are taking in more than you're producing. That's the reuptake part of that equation. And an inhibitor inhibits or stops the reuptake from taking place so that there's more serotonin available to be used in the brain. SNRIs are just serotonin norepinephrine reuptake inhibitors. They work on both. So we got me on a good SNRI. We got me on L-methylfolate, which allows my body to therefore then produce serotonin and norepinephrine, because that's basically the key, the magic ingredient that my body is not able to produce from the foods that I eat. Doesn't matter how much of what I eat, my body will not produce it because I have a gene mutation.
Right.
but I take the L-methylfolate, which is a supplement not covered by insurance, ordered, you know, through an online pharmacy, a compound pharmacy. And we were able to take about 7 different medications off my roll. I was diagnosed with fibromyalgia. We did an MRI. I have osteoarthritis of the spine. I have 2 torn protruding discs, my L4 and L5. And all of these things combined to self-medication in a nutshell. I enjoyed alcohol at first, very much. And there are moments when I still miss it a little bit. A hot summer day, it'd be nice to have a Mike's Hard Lemonade, you know. But I don't miss it enough to ever go back, because being clear-headed, although there are still times when I get really, really severely depressed, that's par for the course. And when I have a bipolar episode, it tends to be a mixed episode. I don't often have depressive or manic. I tend to have mixed. My mania presents itself with not sleeping. For some people, they have obsessive shopping, obsessive sex drive, obsessive drug use, or driving madly, or whatever they do. For me, it's I can't sleep. So I'll go 4, 5, 6 days with literally no sleep. And I'm depressed as hell on top of it, which is pretty miserable, because when you're depressed, you really just want to sleep. To kind of skip through the day, you know, and that's not an option when you're in the middle of a mixed episode. So it's really frustrating. And I've lived long enough to know that it will pass. And I just kind of have to hunker down and hold on and just get through it. And if that means playing games on the computer all day, then I play games on the computer all day. Is it a waste of time? Some might say that it is, but when you're that depressed and you can't think clearly because of it, and you haven't slept in 4 days, you do whatever you can to get by. Basically, yeah. Whatever you can to survive. And so that's the way it goes. My daughter wound up moving in with her dad when she was 15. And that was really hard on me, because I, you know, we'd gone through all this stuff. She had some health problems for about a year. We were in and out of hospitals. We got all that straightened out, but she was out of school. So we were homeschooling. We were together all the time and just at each other's throats. So I think it was probably a good thing that she moved in with her dad. We were able to have a good relationship after that, but it was a major adjustment period for me, because I was going through empty nest syndrome all of a sudden. You know, you expect it when they're 18 and they go to college or move out or whatever they do, but at 15, you're not ready for it yet. And my entire day, my entire life is planned around her, what time we're going to get up based on what we have to do that weekend, or what time school starts, what we're going to have to eat, what I need to pull out of the freezer, what I have to get at the grocery, what we need at Walmart. I mean, everything was wrapped around her and her activities, because I was a single mom on disability, staying at home all the time. So I went through a little bit of a depression after she moved out, but managed to stay sober, for which I was very proud of myself. When I first got out of the hospital, I would do things like not go to the grocery store until after 7 p.m. because the liquor store is closed at 7. And there's a liquor store in the parking lot of every shopping center with every grocery store that exists in this town. Liquor stores are everywhere. And I needed to avoid them for a while. So I had to do some, you know, some rearranging. At the hospital, they recommended that you do 90 meetings in 90 days, which I did. I wound up going to Narcotics Anonymous rather than Alcoholics Anonymous. I just found the AA folks to be, in my opinion, a little bit snooty. And I know that's just the groups that I went to. I'm sure it's not that way everywhere, but NA was much more welcoming. Some people there had a problem with the fact that I was only an alcoholic and not a drug addict. Others recognized that alcohol is a drug and were very warm and welcoming. And after I did the 90 meetings in 90 days, I just didn't feel that I was getting a whole lot from the meetings. So I continued with the 12 steps and rinse and repeat as you go through them, because there are always things for which you need to make amends. There are always reasons to look to your higher power. So I've continued in my journey there and in my study through literature and research online and that sort of thing, but I no longer attend meetings. But that's part of the reason that I want to do things like this podcast, because I want to speak out and let people know that you can be in the pit of hell and get out of it. It is possible. It's hard. And it's scary, and sometimes it's lonely, but it is possible. And so back to, you know, Kate left and it took me a while to find my groove, but I finally decided, okay, I'm going to see if I can work again. With the psychiatrist changing my meds, I had been stable for a good 3 years with only one episode. I thought, okay, let's give it a shot. So I applied for a job as an assistant manager at a local box retail store and got the job. Was promoted to manager. Hated it because they basically want you to work 90 hours a week for a salary with no overtime and no, you know. Stepped back down to assistant manager from the manager position and eventually left that job. There was a situation that occurred one night where the other two employees left. I was in the back mopping up a spill and they just walked out. No notice or anything. It was 10 o'clock at night. They left the door unlocked and left me in there by myself, and no one was reprimanded. No one, not the store manager, nobody. And I said, you know what? I actually gave them 4 weeks notice rather than two. He said, can you stay on for another couple of weeks? I said, yeah, because I didn't have another job lined up. It was the first time since I was 15 that I was quitting a job without another job lined up. But I had enough to live off of for a little while, and I wanted to kind of sit with it and figure out what I wanted to do. So after another 2 weeks, you know, total of 6 weeks notice, the district manager came in one day and I handed him my keys. He said, what are you doing? I said, I'm leaving. He said, you can't do that. And I said, I just did. Because I couldn't wrap my head around how that worked. And after sitting with it for a couple of weeks, I decided to pursue the copywriting full time. And that was in August of 2020. It's been slow and arduous and sometimes difficult, but, you know, I'm managing to stay afloat. I don't know that I would say the business is yet thriving, but it is surviving. It's enough to pay the bills, and that's really what matters when you get right down to it. Shortly after Kate moved in with her dad, a fellow that I had dated when I was 18 got in touch with me on Facebook. We had remained friends. I had actually gone up to North Carolina and met his son. His son and my daughter played together for a little while one day and met his wife. And for me, he had kind of always been the one that got away. And when he looked me up, he told me that his son had died. And I didn't know, because I hadn't really been following him on Facebook. I mean, we were Facebook friends, but I didn't read his profile daily or anything. His son had passed away about a year before. He was playing the choking game and he hung himself. And Richard found him. So he was struggling, understandably so. But we met for lunch at a Mexican restaurant and it was like no time had passed at all. We immediately became best friends again and started dating. That was in August. In December, he moved in with me. His wife had said, before he got in touch with me, his wife had said, if you'd like to date, you know, you're welcome to, because their marriage was based on raising their son. And with him gone, they didn't have anything left. So they divorced, and he and I have been together now for, I guess, about 3 years, 4 years, 3 years, I think. and going strong. He's recently gotten some pretty bad health news. But like anything else, you just keep going. You put one foot in front of the other, in front of the other, in front of the other. And step by step, you make it through. Life is difficult. That's the first line in M. Scott Peck's The Road Less Traveled. He says, life is difficult. And the premise of that book is, once you accept that life is difficult, you can learn to appreciate the good things, the beauty, the laughter, the fun, the excitement, the challenge. If you accept that life is difficult, then all of the rest is just good stuff.
Yeah.
I think I'll kind of bring it to a close with that for now and let you ask away, ask questions.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, thank you for being so open and honest.
Of course.
I really sort of connected with you on some points of your story, you know, with the abandonment issues. That's me straight down the line. That's where my addiction kicked off, or my search for who I was. I didn't know who I was. I was told on my birthday that I was adopted. So that really, for me, was the first big trauma in my life. But it caused me to not only feel abandoned, but everything that I'd been was a lie. So who was I? I spent many years, and I'm still finding out, you know, coming up to 8 years old, I'm still finding out who I am. I'm on my second marriage. A lot of the things that you said about suicide and, the way that you felt, and there's quite a lot of stigma around sort of suicide, especially at the minute. You know, last year I lost quite a few people to suicide, especially on through Facebook. I lost a few people that I knew. I lost my best friend to suicide. He threw himself in front of a train in front of me. I almost lost myself to suicide several times.
Likewise. I've had 3 attempts.
Yeah, I've had a few more than that, but
I figure God's not done with me yet is the only explanation I can come up with.
Yeah.
There's a reason why I'm here. I may not know exactly what it is yet.
It's definitely a faith thing for me. You know, you said about NA and AA, and, you know, I respect the programs and I love the programs, and I work a 12-step program, but I cannot put myself around some of the people because it's just pure hypocrisy. I find it really, really difficult and toxic. Toxicity and toxic people breed toxicity and toxic people. So, in recovery, we have to stay away from that. And I really try hard to stay away from that and to live a positive life. It's not always easy. I still do with my mental health at times. But, I understand with the alcohol and stuff, that was never really, never really a gateway. I enjoyed alcohol too much. I wouldn't have called myself I would call myself an alcoholic, but I think it was more things like coke and crack cocaine and, whatever I could get to put me in a different frame of mind, to flip that frame of mind.
Yeah, to escape.
I think when we the thing about it is, the thing about addiction is, and addiction and trauma and, you know, all the things that, that you've been through and that I've been through, and, you know, a lot of people that I spend my time around have been through, is that addiction and things like that, it's a loss of connection. Mm-hmm. And, the thing that I find is that when you get sober, these connections start again. This is one of the reasons I started this up, to help with those connections. You know, I like collecting stories, as I said earlier, as well, because it's very cathartic for me rebuilding these connections, because I felt so far away from the world, so far away from my family. You know, I almost lost my daughter. You know what it's like. It's not an easy life, but we have to be honest. And I forget what you said earlier, but it really resounded with me. It was this too shall pass. I always struggled with that.
Yeah,
this too shall pass, and I'm thinking, well, yeah, I know this will pass, but it's taking.
What do you do in
long.
The meantime? Yeah.
Exactly, and you know, it's taking a long time, and I think, you know, that's where a lot of people falter and fall. It does pass. Life is not always easy. I agree.
And it goes in phases and cycles. Life will, you know, things will run along pretty smoothly for a while, then you hit a bump in the road. Sometimes you have to climb a mountain. It's not just a bump, it's a big old mountain, you know, and then you come down the other side, and it's that way for everyone. The people who you think have it so perfect, they have their ups and downs too.
Of course they do.
You know, they may not suffer from depression and anxiety, and they may not have quite as difficult a time of dealing with things, depending on their mental makeup, but everybody goes through struggles. We all have trouble. That's just the way life is. And, you know, if you hold on and make it through them, you can, it does lend itself to an appreciation of the good times.
Yeah.
Because you can step back and go, you know, man, look how far I've come. I mean, we didn't really get into this, but there's a lot of guilt when you get sober. Just guilt. A crap ton of guilt, you know, and it can bury you if you let it. I know that God forgives me, and quite frankly, I forgive myself, and that's all I need. I can't control whether or not anyone else is going to forgive me. I can, you know, when I was blackout drunk, there are times when I wasn't even responsible for what I did, but I'm still responsible for the repercussions.
Of course.
You know, you're responsible for the outcome. You may not have known what you were doing at the time, but you're responsible for what happened. And accepting that responsibility is really hard. It's really hard.
Well, of course it is.
But it's also kind of a relief, because you finally get to just be honest and let it go. You know, you don't have to hold all this crap in any longer.
No.
And I sat with that guilt for probably 6 months or so when I got sober. And then I finally said enough, because if I stayed in that place, I would never accomplish anything. It doesn't do you any good to beat yourself up for something that is over and done, because you can't go back and undo it. You can apologize and make amends in any way, shape, or form, you know, whatever you can do, but that's all you can do. And then you got to move on. You just have to. You have to let it go and move on.
Yeah.
And I think that's the difference between being, because a lot of people I know are dry. And I think that's part of the problem that I had with the meetings is, people weren't necessarily living sober, they were living dry, and there's a big difference.
Yeah. Massive difference.
Big difference. You know, you can go for periods of time without drinking, but if you're hating it the entire time that you're doing it, you're not sober, you're dry.
Yeah.
Sober is an acceptance of the lifestyle with no drugs and no alcohol.
Well, exactly. I won't say normal people, but, you know, a lot of people don't understand how actually difficult it is to live a sober life and to even get there, to even get sober. You know, you're only as sober as the day that you live in. You know, yeah. I understand this full well. The thing that you said about guilt and shame, that was a big thing in my life. I suffered survivor's guilt for a little while. Nearly died in 2015. And I suffered survivor's guilt. And unforgiveness was a big, big one for me because, you know, I'll bang on about this in pretty much every interview that I do. Unforgiveness is toxic, it's poison, and it is dangerous. It will tear your life apart because it's like not forgiving someone not forgiving yourself and not forgiving someone is like drinking poison and expecting someone else to die.
Waiting for them to die.
It's not going to work. And I know what it's like to need to forgive myself. I've done a lot of bad stuff in my life, and I've done a lot of sketchy stuff in my life. And I've lost people to suicide. I've lost people to murder. I had to forgive a man that murdered my niece because it was tearing me apart.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the fact that he was murdered in his jail cell goes to say something, but I had to forgive him because it was tearing me apart. And not that I'm not that I'm okay with what he did, because I'm not, and it's not that I'm a Christian.
What a lot of people don't realize is that forgiveness is not necessarily letting somebody off the hook.
No.
They're still on the hook because they still did what they did. Forgiveness is letting go of your angst and your anger and your upset.
Yeah, it's
very personal and almost selfish, but in a good way, if that makes sense, thing to do, because otherwise it'll eat you up. It will flat out eat you up.
It does. You know, I know that as a Christian, I'm commanded to love. You know, the Bible verse that has dogged me through my whole life, even before I became a Christian, was Romans 12:20. You know, I was a man that had enemies. I even had an arch nemesis. At one point, I saw somebody as an arch nemesis. Not normal people have that, you know.
Right.
but it's... You know, it's that whole thing of let go and let God.
Yeah.
You know, because I forgive the people for what they've done to me. I forgive myself for that. And it don't mean that I have to like them. You know, to love someone doesn't mean that you have to like them. It doesn't mean that you have to like what they stand for or, you know, anything. It just means you have to love them enough to keep them away from your mind because it's affecting you and not them. They don't give two hoots about the way that you think.
Right.
So, you know,
acceptance doesn't mean approval.
No, we have to learn that.
You know, you don't have to approve of something to be able to accept it. Some things are just fact and you just have to accept them and move on. Doesn't mean you have to agree. You just have to accept it. The guilt is tough. The guilt is tough because, especially not knowing sometimes what I've done, because I would get blackout drunk and I don't know what I did. And I know that it impacted my daughter because she saw me drunk all the time. That's how I was for about 5 years. I was drunk all the time. I don't know where I was going with that, other than, you know, she has not yet forgiven me. And that's really hard. She may never forgive me. And that's my cross to bear. Yeah. I wish that she would, for her sake, more so than my own, because I've forgiven myself. I wish that she would forgive me so that she's not holding on to that hurt. But that's something that she's going to have to come to terms with and decide whether or not she wants to do it for herself. Totally separate tangent, but recently I read an obituary that said, so-and-so passed away after a long battle with alcoholism and mental health issues. And I thought that was so extraordinary and so brave. And the way that you would want an obituary to read for someone who committed suicide after the struggle of alcoholism and mental health issues, because I know what that's like. And people have sympathy when someone dies from cancer, right? Not so much when it's mental health issues, because there is such a stigma associated with it. But it's no better. It's like a cancer. It eats away at you daily, minute by minute sometimes. And yep. I was very proud to read that obituary. It wasn't mine. It didn't have anything to do with me. I really have no right to feel pride, but I was proud to see that somebody had the chutzpah, you know, to put it out there, because so many people lose that battle. And perhaps if we recognized it more often and acknowledged it, it would be brought to the forefront and discussed like you and I are doing now more often and more readily. And maybe over time we can get rid of the stigma altogether. It's certainly gotten better in the past 30 years. I mean, much, much better. You know, we can have an open discussion about it now.
Yeah.
Never would have happened 30 years ago.
No. No, I mean, I went through it 30 years ago, almost, yeah, almost.
Time flies.
It does. You know, I'd say about 26 years ago, I found myself in hospital after a suicide attempt. And I think that was my first time, and I didn't even really know why I was doing it. I didn't want to live that life anymore. I think there are so many people that try to push it away and say it's a coward's way out. It isn't. Really isn't. I really feel for any families that go through it. You know, I've felt it. I've lost people to it, and it's not nice. I've also lost people to addiction as well, you know. I famously went to 7 funerals in 6 days.
Damn.
You know, but this is the life that we lead. All we can do, we must not regress. Was it the steps saying, you know, in that book, we do not regret the past, no, we should shut the door on it. You know, I know I've done some sketchy stuff. I know that I've caused a lot of hurt and a lot of harm, and there's nothing that I can do about that. That's in the past, you know. Like Rafiki from the Lion King smacking him on the head, and you know, what's it matter? It's in the past. It really is as simple as that.
Yeah, it's over. It's done. Yes.
Letting that take in your head, that's what causes suicide. So we have to keep it at bay, and we have to forgive ourselves and forgive other people, because you know.
Because it'll eat away. It'll just eat away at you if you don't. It is like a poison. It just sits there and it rots and it corrodes everything around it. And if you keep it in your heart, it's going to affect everything else in your life. you know, I don't know how to tell someone to forgive. Only that you need to figure it out. Take the time. It's worth it to learn how to forgive. There are books written on the subject, I'm sure. Tons of them. Yeah. One is called Forgiveness and Other Acts of Love. Because forgiveness really is an act of love. It's an act of self-love. That's one book that I read recently, well, in the past couple of years, that is a really good one. And the biggest thing is coming to terms with the fact that you can't undo. So you have to forgive. You either forgive or you corrode. There is no in between. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I agree. I think that's part of what really drives us in our sobriety, in our clean time, whatever you want to call it, you know, in recovery. It's, you know, for me, I love the fact that our journeys are similar because of, through creativity, you know, love saved my life to start with. Yeah. I met my wife. She was working at the food bank and I was a homeless guy, and she liked my t-shirt and she bought me tobacco and she took me for a meal. And, you know, she's put with some shit over the years, but, you know, we got married in 2019. We've been together 8 years. I forget now. You know, it does. And, you know, and then, you know, when lockdown happened here in the UK, the first lockdown, I really struggled badly with my mental health. And, you know, we could only do the school run. I could only go to the shop when I needed to go to the shop. I'm quite a free bird. I like to go out and get a coffee, and, you know, I like to go to the church and volunteer at the church and things like that. And I couldn't do that. Yeah. I couldn't do it. So I felt okay. So all I did was sit and watch 80s films all day, every day, you know. And I found that really hard. And then, you know, the second lockdown was a bit easier, because it was a bit easier to get out and things like that, because it wasn't as harsh. But, you know, then I started this with Jason Edwards, and it's been a life changer. You know, hence the name, I'm the Accidental Journalist. I never meant to become a journalist. Right. I fell into it. I never wanted to be a journalist, you know.
Well, sometimes life picks you.
It does. I didn't learn to read and write until I was 21 years old.
Wow. And
it's a pleasure. So, you know... But I've always had a head for words. I've always loved words. I've always loved poetry. You know, my first book I wrote was a poetry memoir. And it's just, that's been a massive saviour. And these interviews, it's I was told that creativity and creativeness would save my life, and it has. It has. And I get to do this on a regular basis, you know.
Yeah. Well, it's an outlet. And that's something I think when people are trying to get sober or even thinking about getting sober, number one suggestion I have is find a substitute.
Yep.
If you smoke, chew on a straw. If you drink, switch to coffee or tea or something, but find a substitute, because you're going to be in social situations where other people are drinking and you need to have a go-to beverage.
Yep.
Always. So that you feel comfortable being around others in a social situation, and you've got your drink just like they have theirs. It's just a different drink. For me, coffee.
Coffee.
You know, I quit smoking last year, October 7th was my first day without a cigarette. And I do vape a little bit as a substitute. Planning on getting rid of that in the near future as well. But I'm kind of stepping down, baby steps. You know, first get rid of the drugs and alcohol and then the cigarettes, and we'll get there. I made it through my surgery and all the stuff with Richard around the holidays without a cigarette. So I think I'll be all right. It's just,
it does get easier.
But find a substitute of some sort. Find people that you can be around and be sober, be that your family, new friends, people at a meeting. It doesn't matter where they come from, church, join, take dance lessons. It doesn't matter. Do something so that you find your peeps, people that you can spend time with who know you as a non-drinker. Because the biggest shift is in mindset. When you see yourself as a non-drinker, it ends the discussion for you in your head of do I drink, do I not drink? Just like seeing myself as a non-smoker as opposed to being a smoker.
Yep.
You know, you have to start thinking of yourself as a non-drinker if you're going to stop drinking, or as sober if you're going to stop using drugs, and think about, well, what am I going to do with my time?
Yes.
And what am I going to do when the shit hits the fan? Because it will at some point, and you're going to have to cope. And drugs and alcohol, for the most part, are a coping mechanism. It's a faulty coping mechanism, but it's a coping mechanism.
Yes.
And people who criticize alcoholics and drug addicts forget that. They forget that there's a reason why you started. It may not be the reason that you keep going. That's the addiction talking. But there's a reason why you started. And that was generally to self-medicate. And a lot of times it's people with mental health issues. The two tend to go hand in hand. In part because I think the mental health system is broken. Yes. I don't think it's broken beyond repair. I don't think anything is broken beyond repair. But it needs serious, serious overhaul. And society needs a serious overhaul in how we look at mental illness. Because from mental illness, quite often comes beauty, comes poetry, comes music, comes inspiration. Because those of us who think a little differently, do things a little differently, and create things that other people would never imagine. There's a beauty to it as well. As you know, it's very easy to focus on the negatives of mental illness. But when you look at it more as mental wellness, as opposed to mental illness, then you can start to see some of the beauty that exists within it.
Yeah. You have to realize that. I think what a lot of people don't realize, and what in the past 8 years I've only realized, is there's a difference between mental health and mental illness, you know, mental well-being, and mental longevity. It's you know, the flip sides of the coin. We look after everything, because you know it's not just a mental problem. It's not just a spiritual problem. It's a spiritual problem. It's a heart problem, and it's a soul problem.
It's physical, mental, emotional, spiritual. It hits on all levels.
Yeah, it's everything, and people don't understand that. And that's why I'm so passionate about getting people's stories across, because there are so many people that bang on about, oh, them alkies down there, you know, the causing trouble, or you see the smackheads on the street, you know, or you see somebody stumbling about. Facebook is really bad for all the videos of showing people on things like spice and, you know, and people are laughing at it, but I don't want to laugh. I see it and I want to cry, because, you know, I feel that on a deeper level, because I've been there.
Yeah.
You've been there. And a lot of the people that I speak to, a lot of people that I've spoken to and I'm going to speak to have been there, because it's a journey that not a lot of people can handle. And I think we are the blessed ones, and we are the lucky ones, because we've lived
to make it through. Every day is a blessing.
it is a blessing, but it's a duty to do things like this. You know, I genuinely enjoy doing this. I genuinely enjoy talking to people. I've genuinely enjoyed talking to you. It's a big part of my life. It's a big part of my recovery.
Yeah.
Just to see how other people have done it, and it's not always been the same journey, and it's not always been the same, you know, level. But everybody that I've spoken to on every single one of the interviews that I've done, including the celebrity ones, you never judge a person until you walk a mile in their shoes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what speaking openly and honestly on platforms like this does.
Yeah, but the conversations do.
Yeah, it gives people a chance to see people like me, people like you, and it gives them a chance to walk a mile in our shoes.
To know that, yeah, I've made it through, but that's so far.
Yeah.
There's no guarantee for tomorrow.
No.
You know? And when you remember that, it makes it easier to appreciate the good days.
It does.
Even the days where there's just nothing going on, but you don't feel bad. It's like,
yeah, sometimes it's, if you've managed to get up and out of bed, bonus.
It's a good day, yeah.
If you've managed to make that bed, even bigger bonus. Have you managed to get dressed? Bonus. You know, nothing is minimal. Whatever is big for you is big for you.
Exactly.
And every step, no matter how small, is a step towards a better life.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. That's something that I've had to remind myself. I had, surgery on my shoulder. I was telling you earlier on the 28th of December. And it's a lot of it has to do with self-care and self-love and self-worth and appreciating who you are. And I have to bear in mind, you know, when I have frustrating moments, I can't even stretch to yawn or something. And I'm like, okay, but think about where you were a month ago. You know, it's life is about a crap ton of baby steps.
Yeah.
And you have to appreciate the days when, you know, there are days when you can't get out of bed. And sometimes you just have to say, well, that's okay. It's okay. I'm blessed to have chosen a career where that's typically the case. Worst case scenario, I have an episode and I'm not able to do any work for 2 weeks and I lose a couple of clients. I haven't lost my job. I might lose some clients, which is not good for my reputation. And I would, you know, do the best that I could to say, hey, I'm not going to be able to live up to my end of the bargain.
Yeah.
And I've had to do that. But I have found that when I explain what's going on, because I had an episode about 6 months ago, a mixed episode, and I lost two clients during that period, but I went to them and I explained, I have bipolar disorder. I'm in the middle of a full-blown episode and I'm not going to be able to complete the work on time. I'm happy to offer a refund. And they appreciated my honesty and, you know, might even become clients again down the road.
Yeah.
You just have to be willing to put yourself out there.
Of course you do.
And most people are understanding. Most people are patient and kind and generous, at least one-on-one. Now, groups are a whole different ball of wax, but most individual people at the heart of things are good people. Not all of them, but most. And I find that more and more the more people I discuss this with. I find that most people either struggle with mental illness themselves or they know someone else who does. They have a family member who does. And a lot of times substance abuse, like I said, goes hand in hand. So, yeah, recognizing the little things. If you manage to take a shower that day, double thumbs up. You know? Yeah.
Yeah. I am conscious of the time, and I do, and I thank you ever so much for being so open and honest. I understand you've got a course.
Pardon?
I understand you've got a course coming out.
Oh, I do. I do. That's right. I'd forgotten. I have a group on Facebook. It's called Write Your Own Copy Challenge. That's the name of the group. I'll give you a link if you'd like to stick it in the in the comments. I'll send that over to you in a minute. And it's a 5-day long free challenge where I teach small to medium-sized business owners how to write their own copy. So how to develop a client avatar or ideal client, how to approach them based on their identifiers, how to do storytelling, because storytelling is what draws people in.
Yes.
How to do that effectively in your copy, what to do when and where, and what not to do when and where. And then I do a hot seat on Friday where we spend an hour going through somebody's work together, live, showing people what it's like to work with me.
Brilliant.
That is starting on the 7th of February at 10 o'clock in the morning. It's an hour a day for 5 days, and it is free. Packed with information. I have a 28-page workbook that goes with it. It's a lot of stuff.
I'll put the time differences in there.
Okay.
I am
Eastern. I'm in South Carolina.
Eastern. A lot of my followers are in the UK. So there's
that's 5 hours ahead, I believe. So it'd be
five hours different, 1-2,
you know, but they'll be in the group for a week after the challenge. So people are welcome to come and watch them after the fact. You don't have to make the live. That's not a big deal. I keep them up for a little while. So
brilliant.
The big thing for me is getting the information out. And then if people want to work with me, they can hire me. If not, they still have enough information to really be able to do good work. That's what I'm shooting for.
And that's what we need more of. Education. Yeah. I'm a big believer in we need more education.
Absolutely. And the information is free. I see no reason not to present it or to charge for it when it's, you know, it's out there. I've just consolidated it all.
Yeah. Yeah.
And 20 years of experience kind of feed into that a little bit too, but yeah.
Kudos for that. There's a lot of people that that are out there that do that charge quite a lot of money for that. So kudos for putting it out there in free education.
Oh, thanks. I've had a number of people take the challenge and then take it again and then take it again. I've got one gal that's going to be doing it for her third time.
Well,
because she said, I probably need to cut it back because it's a lot of information in a couple of days. It's kind of a crash course. It's still just the tip of the iceberg, but it's enough to really get somebody started if they want to write their own copy, but they're insecure about their writing ability, or they're just not sure that they're hitting the mark in terms of getting new clients and getting return on investment for ad spots and that sort of thing. It's making sure that they're getting the bang for their buck.
Yeah. I will post the link in
cool
on the video when I edit. Thank you.
In
all the information that I can. Thank you again for coming on.
It's my pleasure.
We'll have a chat in a second.
Okay.
Thank you guys ever so much for tuning in again. You know, I really love having you put your input into this. It's, you know, I've got some of the, you know, best followers that are out there and the most loyal followers that are out there. So I am really, really blessed for that. And I want to thank you ever so much for tuning in. And to those that are watching on Catch Up, which I know many do, thank you for taking the time. I know my videos are sometimes quite long. But, you know, there is a lot to fit in there. for my YouTube, please. This will be on YouTube in the next day or so. You know, if you can, hit subscribe, give it a watch, give it a like. It's always nice. You can find the whole series, first series and second series up to now, on my webpage, which is jwgreg.wordpress.com. And yeah, thanks guys for tuning in, and I shall see you again really, really soon.